James did not know what to expect when he returned home. He thought Baptiste Villeray might have managed to convince Marie to flee with him to Louisiana. If she had, the others no doubt would have gone as well. Annie, Petra, and the children. But as he rode up to his cabin, he saw smoke curling from the chimney. One of Baptiste's wagons stood out by the pole pens James had put up for his few livestock.
Annie! Annie, it's me!
Annie came out onto the dog run into a cold December wind.
James!
He had not shaved in weeks because of the weather. He knew he probably looked more like a Blackwood than a Lewis. But she came running as he stepped down from the saddle. She threw her arms around him in joy.
We heard there were a great many killed. We were afraid for you.
There are more killed of them than there was of us. We won, Annie. It's over.
Annie pulled away and looked beyond him as if hoping to see someone else.
How about Michael? Is he with you?
I never found Michael. He wasn't there. Hasn't he come home yet?
Marie hasn't heard a word. We don't know whether he's dead or alive. It isn't like Michael not to let us know something.
Yes, it is.
Andrew had told James of Michael's penchant for riding away and staying gone, of looking always for some new place he hadn't yet seen.
I'm afraid it's just like him.
But there was fighting in other places besides Bar. We heard there was a fight at La Bahia. He might have been killed.
Does Marie believe he's dead?
No. She says she knows he's alive. She says she can sense it.
Then listen to Marie, and not your fears.
James looked around.
I figured I'd find Sly Shipman with you. Where's he at?
He's gone, wouldn't you know? He went back with Baptiste.
I'm sorry, Annie. I figured you and him would be married by now.
Me? Marry a man who's always up and gone when you need him the most? I wouldn't have him as a gift.
Annie turned away, but not before he saw tears well up in her eyes.
It's cold out here. Go take care of your horse and then come on in and get warm. I'll be fixing you something to eat.
Christmas was not happy for the Lewises on the Colorado River. The weather was damp and unpleasantly cold, and the threat of war still hung over Texas like the leaden clouds of winter. Worst of all for the Lewises was that Michael had not been heard from. Though James would not speak of it to anyone else, least of all to Marie, he was haunted by a fear that Michael had fallen somewhere in one of the scattered skirmishes the Texans and the lately arrived American volunteers had fought with Mexican soldiers from Goliad to the Rio Grande before General Cosa's retreat from Bar. If that were so, he would join many of the other pioneers to early Texas who had been swallowed up by that vast land and never seen again. James grieved inwardly when he was alone, but he tried not to betray his feelings around the others, except for Andrew. Somehow he felt that with Andrew he could unburden himself, for Andrew had always been the one in the immediate family most able to listen with sympathy, to understand, to offer advice and help without impatience. Andrew heard James's fears about their older brother with eyes that couldn't hide misgivings of his own.
I've had the same thoughts. I tried to push him aside because it seems disrespectful to think of him as gone, like Papa that time. I remember when we thought once before that Michael was dead, but he finally turned up when old Eli Pleasant brought him back to Tennessee. Yeah, you weren't big enough to remember much about it, I guess. Yeah, Marie still swears she knows he's alive. Says she can sense that he's out there somewhere trying to get home. Yeah, I guess from there we have to take it on faith. Whatever comes, we'll face it as a family.
The Reverend Fairweather came by on Christmas Day and shared with them some venison and wild turkey at Andrew's cabin, where all the families had gathered.
Oh, the Lord's bounty is generous indeed.
Fairweather led them in a prayer for the safety of Texas and for the return of all the missing, especially Michael.
I ought to be praying for all those men trying to make a new government for Texas over in San Felipe. They argued and fought among themselves until I am not sure the Lord will have patience with them much longer. You should be glad you vacated Bar as soon as you did, James. There arose quite a squabble over putting together an expedition to march on Matamoros and invade Mexico.
I heard a little about it. I decided I had all the fighting I needed for a while.
They're near to coming to blows in San Felipe. Governor Smith is against invasion. So's Sam Houston. You know, they've made him a general and he's trying to raise an army. He says he doesn't want any men wasted on a fool's errand. Says they'll all be needed much closer to home. A big part of the consultation is for an invasion, though. I fear Texas will be so badly divided that the Mexicans can just walk in and swarm over us like hornets.
You think they'll come back? I talked to Elizondo before I left Barr. He believes it's just a matter of waiting for the grass.
I fear it may not be that long. I've heard things that shake me to the core. There are reports that Santa Ana, even now, is marching up toward Laredo with a large army of fresh troops. If that is true, then he will soon meet up with Coase and his 1,000 soldiers on their retreat. When they put those two forces together, it will be a fearsome thing to behold.
Coase gave his promise at Barr that he would never invade Texas again.
Coase is a general, but Santa Ana is the presidente. He can overrule any treaty Coase has made. So you see, young gentlemen, the new year may bring great tribulation to this poor benighted Texas.
I'll pray that you're wrong.
I have prayed the same thing many times. But the Lord does not promise to always send us the answer we want to hear.
Fairweather saddled up after resting a while to let his big dinner settle.
Which way are you headed?
South. There are Texans scattered along the Rio Grande watching for Santa Ana and his minions. I expect they'll be needing to hear the word to gird them for the fight.
You'll inquire about Michael along the way, won't you?
Oh, that I will. He and I have not always gotten along as Christian brothers, but I respect him as a good and strong man. If I find him, I will send word, and if possible, I will send him.
Ah, he couldn't ask no more.
Cousin Frank came out to stand with James and Andrew as they watched Fairweather ride away, moving in a southerly direction with a cold, damp wind blowing at his back.
If he's right, what are we going to do?
I don't see where we have any choice except to fight. That or run.
Andrew took a sweeping look at the land around him.
I put too much into this place now. Me and Petra together. I don't figure to run.
The memory of Velasco had faded but little in 3 years, and Barr was so fresh that James thought at times he could still feel the sharp bite of gunpowder in his nose. He awakened sometimes in the middle of the night, thinking he felt the ground shaking to the roar of cannons and heard the staccato crackle of rifle fire. Any illusions he might have harbored about the glory of battle had been shattered in Velasco and San Antonio.
But the women and the young'uns, Petra and Marie, Hope and Annie.
Yeah, we'll have to send them off to safe ground over to Louisiana. That's why Baptiste left his wagons and teams behind, so they'll have a way if it comes to that. Maybe it won't. Maybe Fairweather's wrong.
The look in Andrew's face told James that he didn't really believe that, and even Frank looked deadly serious. It was a bad sign when Frank couldn't find something to make a joke about.
I think we'd best oil up our rifles.
Something was wrong with Annie, though James could not determine just what it might be. Since his return from Barr, she had not once berated him for his shortcomings, not once placed any imperious demand upon him. She had been kinder than he had ever known her, and quieter. It was obvious she was ill. He came upon her unexpectedly one chilly day when he returned earlier than usual from a trip into the woods in search of fresh meat. He had shot a young white-tailed buck that had had the poor judgment to abandon a hiding place in the underbrush and bound away in fright. He hung it for the moment in the dog run and stepped into the kitchen to warm his hands at the fire before going back out to skin it. He found Annie sitting at the kitchen table, staring at a drawing she had made of Sly Shipman while he had been here the last time. She had not once mentioned Shipman's name since the day James had come home from the fight at Barr and had asked the man's whereabouts. He had thought perhaps she had recovered from her infatuation. She made a quick move to put the picture away, but realized James had already seen it.
Was I you, I'd stick that in the fire and forget about him. He ain't the kind that'll tie himself down.
I wasn't really thinking about him. I was just looking at this, thinking of what a poor artist I am.
You're a good artist, but a poor liar. That picture's a fair likeness. Only trouble is you ought to have done it from his backside, because that's what you see most with him riding away.
You worked with him for a long time. Didn't you like him?
I got to where I did after a while, but I ain't a woman. He's a good friend and partner for a man, but he's got too much travel in him to be good for a woman. As I you, I'd take another look at some of them boys from over at San Felipe.
I don't need them, and I don't need him. I can get along by myself very well.
Annie started to rise up from the table, then sat down quickly, her hands on her stomach. Her face looked pale.
What's the matter, Annie? You don't look good at all.
I guess it's this chilly, damp weather. I must have taken a cold.
I'll make you a fire in your bedroom. Maybe you ought to drink a little whiskey and then go lie down and wrap yourself up real good. Try to sweat the sickness out.
Whatever it was, it seemed to pass in a while. But the next morning, she looked sick again. She started fixing his breakfast, then had to sit down and let him finish it.
I'm going over to see Petra. Seems like she's always got some Mexican remedy for just about anything that ails you. Maybe she's got something to get you over this.
Annie argued that it wasn't necessary, that this wouldn't last long, but James went anyway. Andrew seemed concerned and said he would ride over after a while and look in on Annie as soon as he got a few chores done. Petra said little until Andrew had left the cabin.
You got anything that might help Annie?
Petra studied him with large, dark eyes. James had always thought Petra and Marie had eyes enough alike that they could have been sisters, except that Marie was Spanish and French, while Petra was pure Mexican.
Yes, I have something. It tastes bad, but it can help.
She knelt before a wooden cabinet and brought out a bottle half full of some dark liquid. It looked terrible. He had no intention of removing the stopper and smelling of it.
Is it good for a cold?
Petra considered a moment before she shook her head.
What is wrong with Annie is not a cold.
Then what is it?
If you were married, you would know.
James stared at her, not comprehending for a minute. When the answer came, he rejected it out of hand. But it would not go away.
You trying to tell me Annie's...
Prenada.
He felt a flush of heat rush through his body, anger and confusion and helplessness, all wrapped up together. He almost dropped the bottle.
Are you sure? How do you know?
You forget my children. I have only to look at Annie and I know before she says it.
Why didn't she tell me?
You are a man. You are her brother. She does not believe you will understand.
I understand, all right. It was that sly shipment. I don't know what she could have been thinking of.
She was thinking of love. When there is love enough, you do not think of other things.
Hell of a fix, a war trying to break out around us, and she gets herself into this shape.
Do not be angry with her. She's your sister. Right now, she needs you to love her and be kind to her. It is not a time to blame, to make her more unhappy.
Does Andrew know?
Just Marie and Hope and me. And now you. Andrew will know soon enough. One brother at a time. Now go. Take her the medicine. I will come in a while and see what I can do.
James nodded and turned, his feelings still running in all directions. He stopped at the door.
Petra, you're a good woman. I've got to tell you something. When I first met you, I didn't know what to think, you being Mexican and all. You weren't like the womenfolk I knew, like my mother and sisters, or my brother Joseph's wife back home. I wondered if Andrew hadn't maybe made a mistake. But I know now that the smartest thing he ever done was to marry you. And the best thing Michael ever done was to marry Marie. I doubt I'll ever be lucky enough to find anybody half as good as either one of you.
Petra kissed him on the cheek when he saw a tear run down the side of her face.
Go now and take care of your sister.
Annie had gone to the hearth and was starting dinner when James walked into the kitchen. He held out the bottle.
It looks pretty bad, but Petra says it'll help.
Thank you. I feel better now, but it'll be good to have it for the next time.
James could not take his eyes from her, and she seemed to flinch under his long study.
You want to talk about it?
No. Petra told you, didn't she?
I ought to have seen it for myself.
I'm sorry if you're ashamed of me.
You're my sister. We've fought a lot over the years, but I've never been ashamed of you for a minute. I'm not ashamed of you now.
You'd have a right to be, I guess.
You want me to go and find him? I'll drag him back here by the hair of his head if that's what it takes.
No, I wouldn't want a man who had to be forced.
Does he know?
I didn't know it myself till after he left with Baptiste.
Then I'll have to go find him and tell him.
No, that'd just be another way of forcing him. I wouldn't want him to marry me just because he had to. He'd resent me, and I'd resent him, and we'd just come to hate one another.
I'm sorry, Annie. I don't know what else to do.
There's nothing you can do. I ought to have known better, but I guess you wouldn't know how hard it is when you want something so bad. Or somebody.
Maybe I do. I did things in Natchitoches that I wouldn't want our mother to see.
The families gathered on Sundays at one of the homes, usually rotating from Michael and Marie's to Andrew and Petra's to Frank and Hope's, and finally to James and Annie's. This Sunday was Marie's turn. James and Annie went in one of the wagons Baptiste and Shipman had left behind. James thought it not a good idea for Annie to try to ride horseback, though she tried to argue that in her early stage it posed no risk. They found Andrew and Frank already arrived and standing in the dog run. James didn't like the somber look on Andrew's face. Carefully, he helped Annie down from the wagon, holding her arm firmly until she was safely on the ground. Frank was surprised, for he was used to seeing James let Annie go it alone, either to make it or fall down, however her luck might run. Annie went into the kitchen to join the other women.
You're being mighty gentle with her this morning. Annie have an accident or something?
I guess you could call it that.
It wasn't his place to tell them. James gave his attention to Andrew.
Your face looks cloudy enough to rain.
Petra and I got here first. We found Marie in a bad state. Petra and Hope have been talking to her. I'm afraid it's come to a point where we've got to do something.
James's first thought was Marie might be in the same condition as Annie.
She's sick?
In a way. Sick with worry. I guess she's been feeling a lot worse than she let on. Yeah, she's always been a strong woman, Marie has, but it's come down now to a point that she can't handle it by herself anymore. Now, come on. Let's go talk to her.
James knew at a glance that Marie had been crying. Her face, always thin, was drawn more than usual, and her big brown eyes met his for only a moment, then looked down. She gripped a handkerchief. Petra and Hope and Annie were solemn.
What is it, Marie?
I had a dream last night. I know you all will think it was nothing more, just a dream, but it was more. I saw Michael. I heard him. He was bad hurt, wounded. Lying on the ground somewhere, all by himself, I could hear him calling for me. I could hear him so plain. There is something. I do not know how I can tell it, so you will understand. Always I have been able to sense things with Michael. I have known what he was thinking before he told me. It is like his mind talks to me, even when he does not speak. Always I have felt that Michael was all right, that he was alive. I still feel that he is alive, but I feel that something is wrong, that he is hurt, that he needs me, and I do not know where to go to find him.
You want us to go hunt for him?
I do not know where to tell you to start, and it could be dangerous if Santa Anna comes.
He'll be dangerous here if Santa Anna comes.
Andrew motioned for James and Frank to follow him back out onto the dog run.
Oh, if it was somebody besides Marie, I'd be inclined to say it was just a woman worried to the point of getting a little hysterical. But Marie's never been one for that kind of thing. She's never one to scare at much of anything. You can see she's scared now.
I wish I knew how we could help her.
Only one thing we can do. We gotta try to find Michael.
Frank nodded in agreement. James could not remember his ever disagreeing with Andrew about anything.
But where do we start?
You don't start anywhere. Somebody's got to stay here and watch after the women folk and the youngins. If the Mexicans do come and me and James haven't gotten back, yeah, somebody's got to be ready to take the families to safe ground. That's apt to be the toughest job of all.
Frank was a couple of years older than Andrew, and in many families that would automatically have given him the unspoken authority to make the plans, to delegate the responsibilities. But Frank didn't argue with Andrew.
If that's what you want me to do...
It is. They're dependable and level-headed. You've got a wife and kids of your own. You'll do it right. With all due respect, little brother, you're too young for that job. I'm afraid you might take too many chances. We can't afford that with our families.
So you want me to help you look for Michael?
There's no use in both of us going together. We've got a little enough chance of finding him even by splitting up. Texas is a hell of a big country when you set out looking all over it for somebody lost.
James knew. He had traversed a goodly part of it, first in getting here, then in the period he had spent working the clandestine import-export trade with sly shipmen, and finally in going to the battles at Velasco and Bar.
I'll go south. As I recollect, when Michael rode away from here, he was going to help try to take Goliad away from the Mexicans. Last I heard, Fannin's troops were there. Maybe Michael's with them.
Well, that suits me. I'll go to San Felipe and see what I can find out. Maybe somebody at the council's got a list of the volunteers. Then I'll find out where Sam Houston's army's at. Michael might have decided to join up with it. Yeah, I don't think he'd let himself get caught up in a fool's errand like that bunch marching off to attack Matamoros.
Do you think we've really got a chance of finding him?
Yeah, about as much chance as a lamb in a wolf's den. But he's our brother. We've got to try.
James had never been as far as Goliad before. Known by two names, the older being La Bahia, it had long been second to San Antonio de Bar as one of the three principal Mexican settlements in Texas. The third, far to the north, had been Nacogdoches. Approaching the little settlement, James could see that it had already experienced the war in a painful way. The place was nearly deserted of civilians. Most of its stone houses and its stick-and-mud jacales stood empty. Their inhabitants had fled in anticipation of a coming battle between the Texan forces, which held the Presidio, and the Mexican troops, even now reported marching up from the south. Most of those inhabitants had been Mexican. They had feared mistreatment at Texan hands as much as the likelihood of being caught in the crossfire if and when the soldiers from Mexico set out to take back this presidio they had lost in October to the Bay Prairie Company of volunteers under Ben Milam and George Collinsworth. Now Ben Milam was dead, killed in the December battle for San Antonio de Bar, and Collinsworth had moved on to other duties. The Presidio was under the command of James W. Fannin, temporarily serving as head of the provisional Texas government's armed forces, while Sam Houston was away among the Indians, negotiating for them to keep the peace and allow the Texans to fight just one enemy at a time. Fannin had marched to Goliad as the first leg of his expedition to Matamoros, but had halted here after learning that the Mexicans had greatly increased their troop strength at that ancient Mexican town just below the Rio Grande. Goliad was of strategic value to Texas because it lay some 40 miles from the new port of Copano on the Gulf and commanded the road between the Gulf and San Antonio. James rode toward the forbidding high stone walls of the military presidio. They were gray and cold and inhospitable. He found himself hating Goliad on sight. It was the kind of place that made him think uncomfortably of chains and whips and dungeons. He could imagine that terrible things might have happened there in the past. It had been fought over several times in its 80 or so years. It would be easy to envision the ghosts of its past dead hovering over it, casting a dark curse upon all who entered. He did not intend to remain longer than necessary. He was admitted through the gates without difficulty, for he was clearly American by birth. He suspected that had he been a Mexican, even a lifelong inhabitant of the Goliad settlement, he would have had a considerable inconvenience ever getting that far. He saw men half-heartedly drilling in the open courtyard. There was no Texan uniform. The volunteers wore whatever clothing they'd brought with them, homespun cotton or wool in many instances, or buckskins or flannel. They wore boots or shoes or moccasins, and he noted that a few were barefoot. Hell of a thing in the middle of winter. But Texas was hardly a rich man's paradise. Most settlers here lived from one crop to the next, one hunt to the next. The wolf of hardship and privation was always prowling, always near. He had a long wait before he was finally ushered in to see Colonel Fannin. A native of Georgia, Fannin had just enough West Point training to get him in trouble, some people said. His responsibilities for the army left him little time for helping some farmer find a lost brother, and his impatience indicated that he would rather be doing something else. But he took the trouble to study his roster, running his finger hurriedly down the pages.
Lewis, you say? Common enough name. I find a Henry Lewis here, and a Matthew Lewis, and there's a Nathaniel Lewis with Shackleford's Red Rovers, but I find no Michael Lewis.
My brother. He might have come in early fall, and was probably part of the fight that originally took this fortification.
Well, scarcely any of the men who originally took this Presidio then are still here. They've scattered to other places, other battles.
James felt a letdown, though he had known within reason that he would not find Michael here. In a garrison like this one, with people constantly coming or going, there was no reason for Michael not to have sent word home, to let Marie and the rest of the family know where he was.
Well, sir, I thank you anyway for your time and trouble. I reckon I'll be moving on, hunting for him somewhere else.
He could be with any number of small companies and scouting parties between here and the Rio Grande. You can't hope to find them all.
I'll damn sure make the effort.
Do you know this part of Texas?
No, sir. Never been this far south before.
I'll make you a rough map, and I'll show you where I last knew the various units to be. But I want it understood that you'll memorize this map, and then burn it.
Burn it?
We must recognize the possibilities, no matter how grim they may appear. By going south, there is more than a good chance that you will run afoul of Mexican troops. Should they capture or kill you, it would not do to have such a map found on your person. Now, would it?
I believe I get your meaning, sir.
It did not take Fannin long to draw the map. On it, he included the creeks and rivers and the few settlements at which Texan units might be headquartering, or at least camping temporarily. He handed it to James.
I have to suppose you've taken the probabilities into account.
The probabilities?
That your brother, in all likelihood, is dead. The fact that you've not heard from him in so long, and the fact that a number of men have been killed in skirmishes with Mexican units south of here ever since last fall, leads me to recognize that as the strongest probability.
Us Lewises don't give up till we see the body.
Do you have any conception of how much land lies between here and the Rio Grande? And between here and the Laredo-San Antonio Road?
It doesn't look like so much.
This is a small piece of paper. Those are not paper miles out yonder. I could use your strong right arm and your rifle right here at Goliad. We feel that sometime in the spring, Santa Anna and his minions will be coming again. We intend to stop them at these walls and push them back far into Mexico.
I didn't see that many men out there.
Well, they will be here. There are only a few hundred now, but I expect to have 1,000 more by the time the grass is green and we again face the Mexican soldiers. Even now, we continue to receive recruits from the United States. If you inquire outside, you'll find that a majority of the men within these walls are not long-time residents of Texas. Those all seem to be home, breaking their fields for next spring's planting or dallying at commerce. These men are mostly lately come from elsewhere, willing to fight to protect the lives of their fellow Americans in Texas. Would that more of the Texans themselves would do so.
James could have told him that many of the old settlers would have been content to live under the flag of Mexico, provided the government guaranteed them continued freedom like they had known in the early years here. The loud cry for independence had sprung up mostly from the later immigrants, those who had no memory of a benevolent Mexico that gave them little help but caused them little trouble. He decided, however, that to say such a thing would only start a needless argument. Fannin was known to have begun calling for independence almost immediately upon his arrival in Texas a couple of years ago. Like Travis, but not so vocal about it. Fannin had not spent time in a Mexican jail to pay for his intemperate language.
Between Travis and Bowie in San Antonio and Sam Houston, wherever he is, and our garrison here, we intend to give Santa Anna such a whipping that he will lick his wounds all the way back to Mexico City, if indeed he survives.
James remembered how many had said the battle for San Antonio de Bar would be easy, and how they had thought the contest for the little fort at Velasco would be quickly won. They had said the Mexicans would not fight. Fannin, by implication, was still saying it.
Surely you'd like to be a part of such a victory? It would be something to tell your grandchildren.
James remembered an old saying, "The third time is the charm." He had survived two battles. The third one just might be the last, and he would never have any grandchildren to tell a story to. But he chose to leave Fannin feeling well-disposed toward him. After all, the man had given him his time and the map.
If I can find my brother, I just may come back and join you, sir. We both may.
Well then, Mr. Lewis, good luck in your quest.
Leaving the Presidio, he paused for another look at the dark stone walls. They were taller than the ones at the old San Antonio mission fortress called the Alamo. General Koss had withdrawn his troops into the Alamo for a final stand, then had surrendered because he considered the place indefensible.
Well, maybe Goliad is different.
By all accounts, it was the best fort the Mexicans had built in Texas. It just might be that 1,000 or so well-equipped defenders within its walls could wear down an attacking army, then spill out to crush whatever was left of it. But Fannin was far short of his 1,000, and he might be far shorter of time than he expected, too. If Santa Anna did not wait for the grass, James shuddered at the possibilities. Matamoros lay almost due south of Goliad. As Fannin had indicated, miles on the ground were much longer than they had looked on the small map James had studied and studied, then burned in a small campfire his first night out. The country was less benevolent than that he had come to know in the regions farther north and along the Colorado. It was drier, given to some degree to sand and cactus and low-growing chaparral. Just middling to poor farming country. Probably pretty good for cattle, if anybody had them in considerable numbers. But there was not yet in Texas a big market for cattle, because there were already enough to provide beef for the residents, and it was too far to drive them overland to the old states for sale. Some were slaughtered at the ports for their hides and tallow to be shipped to New Orleans and elsewhere, but the meat would not keep during such a journey. James wondered if anybody would ever find a use for this part of Texas. He found one of the outposts Fannin had indicated on the map, and some 20 men stationed there, patrolling for signs that any Mexican soldiers were moving back into Texas. Colonel Sesma was south of the Rio Grande, at or near Matamoros, he was told, awaiting orders. Reports from friendly Mexicans indicated that Santa Anna was somewhere south of Laredo, moving northward. Surely, though, he would wait for spring. He could not possibly haul enough corn in his wagons to feed all the horses his cavalry would be bringing. The horses would need grass. Relying on his memory of the map, James missed the second outpost he sought and wasted 2 days backtracking until he found it. Someone there thought he vaguely recalled a Lewis, a tall, gaunt man. Best he remembered, he looked a little like James, except older. It had been 2 months ago or longer, so he'd forgotten if the name was Michael. Could have been, or maybe not. James learned only enough to fire up his hope, yet leave him frustrated and a little angry.
Can't you remember anything else? Can't you remember where he was going the last time you saw him?
The speaker was not a Texan of long standing. He'd come from Alabama back in the fall, just about the same time the first blood was being spilled at Gonzales. He'd been spoiling for a fight with the Mexicans, and up to now he'd seen a lot of Texas, but very little of the enemy.
Well, best I can recollect, this Lewis went a-riding out with a patrol that was headed down to the Bravo to whip up on any Mexican stragglers they could find, and be damn sure they went across the river. Ain't none of that bunch ever come back, as far as I know. It could be they run into too many Mexicans. Me, I'd like to run into a few. I ain't had to barrel old Hickory here good and hot since I got to Texas. I just hope them Mexicans do come. Time we get done, what's left of them won't quit running till they get to Mexico City.
If all the reports were even half true, James thought, the Alabaman would get his wish. A man ought to be more careful about what he wished for. Somewhere north of the river was supposed to be another patrol unit watching for signs. Fannin had warned that it was not permanently stationed at any one place, but remained mobile. It was mobile enough that James almost despaired of finding it. In the end, he did not find it. It found him. Three men rose up suddenly out of the chaparral, leveling rifles at him.
Don't any of y'all shoot!
One of the men lowered his rifle part way.
You're an American?
Used to be. I'm a Texan now. Come from over on the Colorado River, west of San Felipe.
We've seen you from a good ways off. There's been a report of some Mexican soldiers, outriders maybe, scouting for a column. For all we could tell, you might have been one. You seen any?
I haven't seen a human being in 3 or 4 days.
James explained his mission and described Michael.
I know the man, but knew him anyway. Him and two more, they rode out from camp 4 or 5 weeks ago. None of them ever showed up again. I hate to be the one to carry bad news, friend, but I'm afraid they must have run into something too big for them. Otherwise, they'd have been back. I'm afraid your brother's dead.
James felt his throat tightening and his eyes burned. It was the news he had come to expect, but he had not made up his mind to accept it.
You never actually saw him killed, though. You never saw his body.
When a man falls in this country, you ain't likely to ever find him. All you know for sure is that he's gone.
You know which direction he rode?
Nope. I was out on patrol myself when they left. Never did hear anybody say. You have to talk to Captain Jones.
I'd like to. Which way is he?
The man pointed west.
Well, camp's over yonder way about 8, maybe 10 miles. Gonna be a mite hard to find. We keep it hidden, so it will be.
The man gave James a little description to help him locate the site.
Good luck to you, friend. Sorry we handed you a scare. Wish I could give you more hope about finding your brother, but truth is truth.
James stared west, his hope rising, falling, and rising again as he pondered the man's words. At least he had found where Michael had been. He had just ridden into a wide, brushy draw, splashed through a cold little stream, and had come out on the far side, back into the lower-growing chaparral brush, when he saw a dozen or so riders. Instinct told him they were Mexican cavalrymen before he made out the color of their uniforms. He felt a flush of excitement, a quickening of his heartbeat. They saw him at almost the same instant that he saw them, and they came charging from 200 yards away. Hi-yah! The muskets the soldiers carried were notoriously inaccurate at any distance, one reason the sharpshooting long rifles of the Texans had done so much more damage in Bar than the defending Mexican troops had been able to accomplish. But James knew the cavalrymen had an answer for that. Get closer. He felt they were gaining on him. He'd not given Walker much rest or grazing time since he'd left home and the horse was wearing down. He hit the heavy brush at a run and was quickly swallowed up in it. He cut to a northerly direction, picking his way through the thorny branches. He slowed to a walk, stopping frequently to turn an ear back in the direction where he thought the cavalrymen should be. James stopped after a bit, dismounted, and led Walker into a patch of particularly heavy brush that he could not have ridden into. This, he reasoned, was as near to being a hole as he was going to find on short notice. He halted when he came to a tangle of limbs and thorns that he couldn't lead the horse through. They seemed to have split up and were beating through the timber in several directions. None seemed close to James. He stood with a hand on Walker's nose, ready to clamp the nostrils shut if the horse gave a sign of nickering to the Mexicans' animals. But Walker seemed to sense the danger, for he was nervous, rolling his eyes a little. The sounds of pursuit gradually died away. They had probably given up and gone after other prey, but it was also possible that they were setting a trap. He decided to stay put for a while. He took a piece of jerked venison from a pack tied to his saddle and chewed on it. He was not hungry. If anything, the chase had ruined any appetite he might otherwise have had. But he knew he'd be needing his strength. These were not likely to be the only Mexicans around. He wished there was some grass in this heavy thicket for Walker, but the density of the foliage during the growing season would have kept it shaded out. James waited. Somewhere to the west, another Texan patrol should be operating under a Captain Jones. With Mexican horsemen prowling about, however, there was no telling where the patrol might be at any given time, or if it still existed. If the men were not alert, they might have been surprised, as James had been, possibly without a thicket to lose themselves in. He wondered if such a thing might have happened to Michael. Toward dusk, he began picking his way back out of the heavy timber, leading Walker at first, eventually remounting when the brush became thin enough to ride through. He found the creek and let the horse drink his fill, while James looked carefully in first one direction, then another. He saw nothing to indicate that the soldiers were still anywhere around. He had no clear idea just what to do next. He didn't want to abandon the search for Michael, but he was beginning to realize that his chances of finding his brother were painfully slim, especially now that Mexicans were patrolling the region. If he remained here much longer, chances were great that he'd be caught and probably killed. What Fannin had said about the reason for destroying the map was beginning to take on a new dimension of cold reality. To continue to roam around this part of the country presented a hazard far greater than any chance he had of finding Michael. Regretfully, he decided to start back north. Michael probably already had, if he was still alive. It was almost full dark when he ventured out of the thicket on its east side. He had waited in the edge for some minutes, watching, listening, hearing nothing except the calling of a few birds. His courage girded up, he finally touched his heels to Walker's sides and moved out into the open. His confidence was shaken, however, when Walker swung his head to the left and pricked his ears forward. James's heart leaped. A horseman charged at him from no more than 50 yards away. They had set a trap, and he had blundered into it. He wheeled Walker around. Walker missed a step, almost falling, but the horse regained his feet and plunged headlong back into the brush. They had known he had to come out of the brush. They had just not known where. He felt Walker beginning to falter. Then his legs went out from under him. James kicked his feet free of the stirrups as the horse went down. He hit the ground rolling, scrambling out of the way. Walker's thrashing hooves could be as dangerous as the cavalryman's muskets. Jumping to his feet, he turned back toward the horse and saw blood gushing from a wound in the bay's chest. He wondered how Walker had made it this far. He grabbed his fallen rifle and his shot pouch. He looked for a moment at the dying animal his Uncle Benjamin had given him, a gallant horse that had brought him to Texas and had carried him over a large part of it during the last several years. Now James was losing him. He had no time for grief. He paused to pat the animal on the neck, then took off running afoot through the brush. Branches slapped at him, thorns clutched, stopped him, dug into his skin and bled him, but he struggled free and kept going. He tried to lick his leather-dry lips, but his tongue was just as dry. But he could also hear the soldiers hunting for him in the heavy timber. That kept his blood pumping, his feet moving. He wished he had taken time to retrieve the pack of food tied to the saddle, but he had not thought of it in his haste to get away. He buried himself deep in the brush and lay down flat on the ground behind a tall clump of prickly pear, fighting against the fear that threatened to paralyze him as he heard the pursuers breaking through the timber, coming closer all the time. Darkness came as a friend. He heard a horse moving very near, possibly no more than 50 feet away. But James could not see him or his rider, nor could the horseman see James. He held still as death, taking short breaths and holding them. The horseman passed on by and soon was gone. James sat up finally as the moon arose cold and bright over the heavy thicket. He took stock of his situation and found it bleak. Here he was, afoot, without food, in a part of the country he had never seen, surrounded by Mexican soldiers on the lookout for him. He had not found Michael, and now knew there was no hope whatever that he would. He would do well if he got out alive himself. The only thing in his favor was that he had kept his rifle and his shot pouch and powder horn. He waited until he heard no sound of the horseman for what he thought had been an hour or more. Then he got to his feet and found the creek. If he followed it upstream, it would lead him in a generally northerly direction. That was as good as he could ask for under the circumstances. Maybe by daylight he could put some miles behind him. He had a lot of miles to travel. Isaac Blackwood stood on a narrow rifleman's walkway behind the high stone wall and stared out over the town of San Antonio de Bar, beyond the river that ran almost beside the mission compound. He could see Mexican people leaving, afoot, in ox carts, and on horseback, most of them heading eastward. Rumors had been circulating for days that Santa Anna had crossed the Rio Grande at Laredo and was on his way with a huge army. Most of the officers had taken the reports with skepticism, if not outright disbelief. It seemed only logical that Santa Ana would wait for spring, for the grass, to march northward into Texas now in the dead of a wet, cold, and miserable winter, without fresh grass for the horses along the way, seemed highly improbable for a man who had Santa Ana's reputation as a military strategist. There was a tendency among some of the officers, like Travis, to dismiss any report of Mexican origin simply because it was Mexican. But the Mexican people of Barr seemed to believe it, for many were putting the town behind them. They remembered too well the storming of Mexican troops by the Texans in December and the carnage that campaign had wrought. They did not want to stay and witness another like it. Isaac had a cold feeling in his stomach as he watched the exodus. Some would say good riddance. They wished all the Mexicans would leave. But Isaac took it as a bad omen. Down in the open plaza, within the fortress walls, he watched Alejandro Zaragoza standing with his son, a boy Isaac took to be around 14. He had heard him called Manuel. The two were arguing with considerable emotion. He surmised by the pointing and other movement of the hands that Zaragoza was telling the boy to leave, and the boy was begging his father to let him stay. At length, the argument ended. Isaac watched the two embrace each other. The boy mounted a nice-looking black horse and rode out the open gate, looking back over his shoulder. Isaac thought he was crying. Zaragoza followed his son to the gate and stood watching him as he rode across the wooden bridge toward the heart of the town, the old San Fernando Cathedral, and the main plaza. When the Mexican finally turned, his dark eyes were sad. Isaac moved a little, for his leg had cramped. Zaragoza looked up, recognizing him. He nodded. Isaac nodded back. He had known Zaragoza by sight almost from the time he and his brothers had come into Texas, back when Zaragoza had been an officer in a more benevolent Mexican army. Until lately, Isaac had been able to develop no particular liking for the man, and Zaragoza had been cool toward Isaac, making no distinction between him and his older brothers. Isaac had never felt comfortable around Mexicans, even though there had been times he wished he could. The Moreno family near Nacogdoches, Andrew Lewis's in-laws, had treated him kindly and generously once when he had badly needed kindness and generosity. Zaragoza's past experience as a soldier had been called into service here in the preparation of this old abandoned mission for the defense of Barr. He had helped organize and drill a small company of Mexicans hostile to the tyranny of Santa Ana, and to work them into the military apparatus commanded jointly here by the young lawyer Buck Travis and the ailing, hard-drinking Jim Bowie. The fact that Zaragoza's men were Mexicans was conveniently overlooked in the garrison's dire need for manpower. Earlier, Isaac had strongly considered leaving when Texas and Bowie together had a force of only a little more than 140 men. He remembered that General Cos had had more than 1,000, yet he had felt himself unable to hold this post. Isaac had been put off also by the earlier quarreling between Bowie and Travis over the rightful leadership. They had settled the matter, more or less, by dividing the command. Travis was in charge of his regulars and Bowie of his volunteers. Then 13 men from the old states had arrived, including one Isaac remembered well from Tennessee, at least by reputation. He had never seen the man before, but he knew the name, David Crockett. Travis had taken cheer from these recruits and told the men he expected shortly to see the garrison swell to 1,000. Isaac had no idea where another 800 had come from, but he had decided to stay and see. Given that many, let Santa Ana come. The Texans would give him a hell of a fight and send him running back to Mexico without his britches on. But now the signs were bleak. The best Isaac could tell from a rough count was that only about 150 fighting men were within the heavy walls. And despite what the officers were telling the men, the hurried departure of civilians from the streets of San Antonio was an omen too dark to ignore. At times he thought about taking his horse and riding out that open gate, joining the civilians in their flight. After all, he was no soldier. He had joined the fight against Mexico of his own free will, and he could quit it the same way. He wondered what prevented him. He supposed he was just waiting for someone else to start, to be the first. Then he would follow. There should be no shame in running if others were doing it. And when it had come down to the cutting, Blackwoods had almost always run. That was their family pattern. His father Cyrus had run 20 years ago, deserting a young Michael Lewis in the face of danger from Spanish troops. His brother Finnis, a few years later, had ambushed Michael and had run when he missed his shot. Maybe, at last, it was time a Blackwood stood his ground to prove that the blood was not all bad. Or perhaps he was just proving another belief widely held about the Blackwoods, that none of them were very bright. He was surprised to see Zaragoza climb up to join him. If they had not developed a real friendship within these walls, the shared experience had made them tolerant of one another. Watching Zaragoza send his son away had touched a responsive chord in Isaac. It brought home to him the fact that though they might be of different races, different cultures, they were all similar human beings at the core. Zaragoza looked out across the top of the wall, silent for a moment. He was gazing in the direction Manuel had taken.
Can you still see him?
He is gone. I told him he must go.
He didn't act like he wanted to.
I told him one Zaragoza in his compound is enough. I told him the danger is great, that he is young, and I want him to live to be a very old man. I told him also that he is the oldest son, and if I am gone, his mother will need him.
You talk like you don't think much of your chances, our chances.
I was a long time a soldier. In my heart, I am still a soldier. A soldier stands where he is needed, and he fights and does not count the enemy. But you are not a soldier. I wonder why you stay.
I wonder myself. I guess it's because the others do. An old Crockett down there, I can't even remember the first time ever I heard about him. Don't seem right for one Tennessean to run away and leave the other one to do the fighting for him.
And your brothers? What of them?
Odd thing about them. All these years I've wanted to get away from them and have my own life, I always stayed because I thought they needed me. Now I'm here, and they're way east yonder, and they ain't sent no message begging me to come home. Maybe they don't need me like I thought.
Perhaps what you do here is for them. If we can stop Santa Ana, if we can even slow him down, perhaps we will give the Texas Army time to be ready.
But is there a Texas Army? From all I've heard, it's scattered to hell and gone, what there is of it, and everybody fighting so hard amongst themselves that they ain't got time for fighting Santa Ana.
I think they will awaken when they see the enemy coming. They must.
Zaragoza's gaze went back to the town, to the flat-topped stone and adobe houses, to the tower of the San Fernando Church. He was still looking for his son.
He's gone. He's a good boy, I reckon. He done what you told him.
A good son. You are a bachelor, I believe. You do not know what it is to have a son.
I reckon not.
Isaac had tried not to think too much about the boy. He had especially tried not to dwell on what would become of young Cyrus, without Isaac there to guide him, and only Finnis and Luke to model after. If he were now to jump and run from this place to save himself, it would be to spare the boy that fate.
Perhaps God will smile. Perhaps Santa Ana will turn back from these walls when he sees we are ready.
Isaac saw a rider spurring hard from the direction of town. It was a Mexican civilian, a man whose face had become familiar to Isaac, though he did not know his name. His excited manner brought Isaac to full attention, and automatically his gaze went to the southern horizon, searching. The bell was in the tower of the San Fernando Church. It was not the time of day for mass. He saw frenzied movement in the distant streets. Men on horseback were hurrying toward the fortress. Texans and volunteers from the United States who had been sleeping in town instead of inside the crowded post. Shortly, a group of Mexican civilian horsemen came pushing a herd of cattle toward the walls, beef to withstand a siege.
It is Juan Seguin and his men. I must go to help them. You know what this means. The enemy is upon us.
The cold, damp wind gave Isaac a chill that seemed to go all the way to his boots.
And the grass ain't even up yet.
Lieutenant Diaz had expected to return someday to San Antonio de Bar, but he had not thought it would be with such a grand army as this one. At least, it had seemed a grand army when it had gathered at the Rio Grande. The steady march into a cold, wet Texas winter had been a grievous ordeal for men afoot and for the horses. There had been little grass from Laredo north, partly because of the dormant winter season, and partly because Texan scouts had done the best they could to burn off the old dead grass that at least would have filled the horses' bellies, even if its nutrients had been sparse. Rain had put a stop to the burning, but the grass was brown and empty, and the animals had grown thin. The Presidente had gone into a rage over the condition of the horses, almost as terrible as the one in which he had indulged upon learning of General Cosa's disgraceful surrender of troops at Bar in December. The men should have fought to the death, he had shrilled, rather than surrender to such an unholy band of pirates as these accursed Americanos who would wrest Texas from the bosom of its mother Mexico. But he would show the foreign invaders the power of the Napoleon of the West. They would feel the sting of good Mexican steel. He would put them to the sword, every last misbegotten son of a goat. The army had struggled badly in the days since February 16th, when it had crossed the Rio Grande. There had been a pause at the Nueces for hasty rebuilding of a wooden bridge, evidently burned by Texan scouts in hopes of delaying the invasion. At the Medina, Santa Ana had called a halt for a day of rest to allow the lagging battalions to catch up. There, friendly arrivals from San Antonio had told the president that the Texans were to have a big dance in town the following night, that it would be easy to steal in under cover of darkness, catch them drunk, and do a quick and easy job of execution. Santa Ana had been intrigued by the possibilities, but a heavy rain and a rise in the river delayed his movement. It was probably just as well. The same rain had probably spoiled the Texans' dance. They would be angry enough about that to put up a good fight. All along, Santa Ana had wondered if the Texans might fortify the old Mission Concepcion south of town and make their stand there instead of in the Alamo, where Cos had found his position untenable. The walls of Concepcion would be more difficult to breach than those of the Alamo. But informants coming from San Antonio said the defenders were still fortifying the Alamo. They had built up new breastworks and filled in gaps in the walls left by the December siege. They had cannon, and they had the long rifles that could reach out and kill a man at 200 or 300 yards. Diaz's thoughts drifted to his old commander, Zaragoza. He wondered what the lieutenant was doing now, if he and his family had evacuated their farm and moved to a safe distance from the battle that was about to take place. Surely the lieutenant had not taken up the Texan cause. The president had declared this a racial war, Mexican against Americano. It was unthinkable that any true Mexican could hesitate about choosing his side. Yet Diaz knew that many had done so. Men like Lorenzo de Zavala and Juan Seguin had turned against their race, had taken up the call for an independent Texas. That meant an American Texas. There would be no place in it for Mexicans. The turncoats would learn soon enough who their true enemies were, should the unthinkable happen and the Texans win. Once their services were no longer required, the Texans would turn upon them and drive them out, taking for themselves all the properties the disloyal Mexicans left behind. He could only hope that this was not the case with Zaragoza. There were others in San Antonio who deserved no better, but Zaragoza was a good man, a good soldier, a true Mexican. As the column approached the town, Santa Ana sent Colonel Mora to take possession of the Concepcion Mission, to keep it from the hands of the Texans should they decide upon wholesale retreat to a better position than the Alamo. Diaz could hear the sounds of musketry in the distance, and knew Mora's troops were caught in a skirmish. It was not of long duration, and a courier soon reported back that the mission was firmly in hand. The Texans who had challenged the column had fled back toward the town, toward the Alamo. The president was pleased. Now it was time to show these invaders the shine of Mexican steel, to vindicate the honor of the Mexican army so besmirched by the unwillingness of his brother-in-law Cos to stand and fight. He ordered his men into full-dress uniform. Diaz carried a small diary in his pocket. In it, he had marked the important dates.
February 16th, crossing the Rio Grande. February 17th, the Nueces. February 21st, the Medina.
Now he took out a short pencil and noted this date.
February 23rd, 1836. Entering San Antonio de Bar.
The president himself rode just behind the advance guard, resplendent in his best uniform. As he entered the main plaza, before and behind him fluttered the banners of the various army units, and the red, green, and white flag that symbolized the glory of Mexico. The eagle with a snake in its teeth, its claws clutching a cactus. Soon, Santa Anna would have a snake in his teeth, and he would administer to these invaders such a terrible defeat that never again would Americans even consider crossing over the Sabine. Never again would military scholars devote all their attention to Napoleon Bonaparte. They would marvel at the greatest warrior of them all, the Napoleon of the West, General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. The red flag of no quarter was raised over the tower of the San Fernando Church. The 18-pound cannon at the Alamo was fired toward the city in reply. The battle for the Alamo had begun.